I love being a bit rubbish, kind of, in the wrong way. It's a strange way to put it, but I love challenge and I love being pushed and I love being at the edge of my capabilities. And that's what lights really does light me up.
Are you sick of vague, contradictory, irrelevant, or unachievable career or self-help advice? Do you have a lot of different passions, but are unsure where to start or what the most meaningful next steps should be? Well, welcome to False Summits. I'm Daniel Mostovac, your host. Really happy to have you here. I'm a serial learning experimenter and question ferret, and on this show, I curate and reflect on stories and strategies that make a successful, self-directed and curiosity-driven career and life, featuring some interviews from some Australians who've been there and done it and are still doing it, all to help inspire and educate you on your own personal journey. Thank you for tuning in and for joining the conversation. Let's get to it. David Bott is the Associate Director of the Institute of Positive Education. David has been involved in training thousands of teachers from hundreds of schools around the world in implementing and sustaining individual and whole school approaches to well-being. I met David online, that is, when my school began adopting the curriculum of positive education to help our students be more self-directed and conscious of their skills, talents, and well-being. In this new age of Zoom meetings, David stood out to me as perhaps the most enthusiastic Zoom presenter I've yet encountered, and we're here today to talk about flourishing, flow, and overcoming adversity in our formal education and beyond. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks, Daniel. It's a lovely introduction. Appreciate that. And it's pretty easy, to be honest, to be enthusiastic about this work, certainly from my perspective. You know, it's the work we're doing with people like yourself and schools like yours are really inspiring for me personally. And I have such a deep interest in well-being science and human flourishing. And so any opportunity to share with people to talk about this work, it's pretty easy for me to get excited about. So really appreciate the opportunity to have a chat with you as well. Thanks, Daniel.
Great to hear. Well, let's dive in then and let's talk a bit about the Institute and what makes you thrilled to go into work there every day.
Yeah, it's my job is pretty unique. Well, it's absolutely unique. This is the only Institute of Positive Education that exists in the world that looks anything like our one. I'm currently sitting inside of Geelong Grammar School in just outside of Melbourne, Australia, and it is a pretty normal school. It's is one of Australia's leading schools, but it's a pretty normal school, yet it has this dedicated research and training institute inside of a school. Our team of about 10 full-time dedicated people are completely invested in understanding, translating the science of well-being so that educators like yourself and others around the world can best leverage this emerging science. So for me, it's just the best job in the world. I have a deep passion for education. I was my mum's teacher, so it's in my blood. I taught for 15 years in the classroom, and I also have a background training in psychology. And so the work that I'm doing now really is this intersection of education and psychology and well-being. And I my job is every day I get to come in and read the latest science, speak to world-leading researchers and thinkers and educators, and then just try and share this work with as many people as possible. And so it really is a dream job for me, and it's just something I deeply passionate about personally. And to be honest, look, we've seen this big impact. You know, it's pretty rare for a school like Geelong Grammar School or for an educator like myself to have a platform that's this kind of impactful across the globe. And so just really the right place at the right time about 10 years ago in my career where I kind of got involved in this movement that's having a pretty big impact around the world. So it's really exciting to be part of it.
Awesome. And so it sounds like it's been going for a while and that there's been some momentum. Has there been much development since maybe the last 10, 15 years in the sense of positive education, the science that's been developing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think in some ways, positive education is not new. Like Geelong Grammar is 165 years old, you know, and schools like ours have been doing well-being forever since they were invented. You know, all schools around the world have an emphasis on well-being of children. That's nothing new there. I think what's new with positive education, though, is that the systematic approach to harnessing cutting-edge science to do well-being in a really systematic way is new and different. And I think that's the point where positive education began at Geelong Grammar School, first school in the world to adopt positive education, 10 or 12 years ago now. You know, the emphasis, it was just really an exaggerated, elevated emphasis on well-being. You know, well-being was already fine and school was going fine, but there was a decision made to really dive deeply into emerging wellbeing science and to grab that by its horns and really immerse that, embed that into the heart of a school. And to your question, you know, 10, 12 years ago, the field was pretty new. Well, there wasn't a field called positive education. It was kind of created here. There was a field called positive psychology, which was really birthed by Professor Martin Seligman from the University of Pennsylvania around the year 2000. So there was this burgeoning science of positive psychology, which is the science of human flourishing. Geelong Grammar became the first school in the world to grab that science and embed it into the heart of the school here. And so we kind of created this field. And as a result of that, we made a lot of mistakes and we fumbled our way through it. And we took the best science that was available and tried to translate that into a school setting. And so for the last 10 or 12 years, we've had some wonderful successes and made a big impact. And we've made loads of mistakes because it's hard to do what we're doing, which is to really shift the philosophy of education a little bit to say that, you know, there is nothing more important than the well-being of children. And therefore, we have a deep obligation as education professionals to understand and to translate the best science we have available to do well-being the best we can, you know. So, yeah, things have changed a lot. The science is constantly evolving. We're learning a lot, especially about the application of the science into schools. You know, so we're trying it out. We're working in our own school with schools around the world, with government organizations to do the best we can as we kind of create this field on the fly, which is really exciting. So it has evolved a lot and we're still learning a lot.
Yeah, that's great to hear. I think that's what we need in the future, that systematic approach and also that love of learning. So positive psychology has been defined as the science of humans at their best, and positive education extending this to be the science of humans at their best in schools. So what do you think it means for a person or a human to be at their best? What does that mean?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think positive psychology really was created when there was a recognition by Professor Seligman and others that we had this amazing field of traditional psychology that really exploded onto the world stage in the 1950s and 60s, really post-Second World War, when largely American soldiers were returning from war damaged, mentally damaged, and the field of traditional classical psychology was designed to really help those people reintegrate and to be okay, to help them deal with the devastating mental impact that had happened during war, you know. And obviously psychology is older than that, and Freud and Jung and many others were already working in this field of mental health or mental illness. But 1950s saw an explosion in the field of positive of traditional classical psychology, to the point where we reached, you know, around the year 2000, and we had a really sophisticated science of psychology that was designed to help people who were struggling. I think around the year 2000, that sort of the turn of the millennium, there was a recognition that whilst psychology as a field had been massively helpful for so many people, what it really was not doing was impacting people that were doing okay. You know, so Seligman and others decided to really leverage the whole apparatus of traditional classical psychology and use that also to try and enhance the lives of normal people, you know, to take what we learned about mental illness and apply it to mental health, you know. And so I think, and again, that approach isn't entirely new. You know, I think if you go back through Eastern philosophy and even, you know, even traditional Western philosophy and religions, you know, there's always been an emphasis on trying to enable humans to live flourishing lives, to live rich, full, meaningful lives in, you know, in harmony with others. That's an entirely human instinct. But I think the scientific approach to that is what's really exciting. And so human flourishing as defined by the field of positive psychology is really a holistic approach to six domains, if you like. And they are positive emotions, positive engagement, positive relationships, positive meaning, positive accomplishment, and positive health. And it's really when we combine all of those six domains of human experience, that we have the possibility to live this rich, full, meaningful life of contribution and engagement. It's not, by the way, about happiness. You know, this is one of the big misunderstandings in the field, that positive psychology or positive education is trying to make kids happy all the time, trying to make people happy. It's not. In fact, what we see in the literature, in the science, Daniel, is that people who have the highest levels of flourishing also have a significant level of challenge in their life, and they experience negative emotions and really healthy balance of disappointment and frustration and challenge, you know, combined with a really healthy balance of really positive emotional experience as well. So this is not, certainly not about trying to make people happy, but it's trying to enable people to live rich, full, meaningful lives where they're fully engaged and able to contribute in a really meaningful way to their communities.
I think it's great, yeah, to demystify a little bit of that sometimes, especially when we hear things in the media, perhaps, yeah, we might get that impression. And even sometimes I've heard this idea, you'd be very familiar with this, of course, about deliberate practice and how sometimes we might think that that's all we need to become really good at something or to enter a state of flow. And I was just reading recently about this contrast between deliberate practice and deliberate rest, and how that sense of disconnection and rest can actually really help us to be creative as well. Is that something that you would encourage, and what does that look like in your experience?
Yeah, it's a great question. Again, I think we're really connected to the work of Anders Ericsson and others in the field of deliberate practice, because our work is really about optimizing human flourishing. A big part of that is about optimizing human performance, you know, because humans are a goal-oriented species, and so we are really only at our best when we're progressively, actively moving towards meaningful goals. And therefore, a big part of positive education is about optimizing performance, optimizing our ability to perform well as we move towards our goals. And they may be academic goals or personal goals or whatever they are. So really, a big chunk of our work is about performance optimization. And that's where Anders Ericsson's work has been so influential. He's based out of Florida State University, and he was really the guy that created this concept of deliberate practice. And as you know, deliberate practice is absolutely essential for mastery of any skills. It's about a really intentional focus on practicing micro skills with mentors and coaches helping you along the way. It's a recognition that practice sucks when it's done well. It's hard and it's not much fun, and that's the only real way to progressively move towards mastery of any skill. So deliberate practice, absolutely essential part of the work we're doing in classrooms with educators and trying to embrace that field. I think deliberate rest is also a really important element of well-being. And I think, you know, what we've recognized over the past 10 years with positive education and probably positive psychology more broadly is that whilst humans have an amazing capacity to pursue goals and pursue different summits, as maybe as you might put it, we also need downtime. You know, humans are designed to be resting a lot of the time. Our natural state is a state of rest. Our homeostatic biological programming is designed to cause us to rest whenever we can. You know, our brain switches off very quickly into a kind of standby mode when we're not actively pursuing food or our goals or whatever. Like, so our brain and our body are designed to rest. And you know, we're starting to learn a lot more about our default mode network as well in the human brain, you know, this kind of relaxed state inside the human brain where traditionally that's often been thought of as time wasting or daydreaming or something, you know, that if we're not actively doing something or actively processing, okay, you know, that's tended to be seen as a waste of time or a waste of capacity or whatever. But I think more and more we're starting to understand that this human default mode network in our brain, which is this kind of relaxed neurological state of rest, really, is actually maybe as important, maybe more important than the really active neurological states where we're deliberately processing something, deliberately practicing something cognitive. So yeah, so it really is about a balance of optimizing our practice and at the same time optimizing our rest and giving our brain a chance to really process and digest and create really powerful new neural mm-hmm. connections in that rest state.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. Let's take a minute and Appreciate where you are. If you're at the gym, you're pumping iron, you're going for a walk, hopefully it's sunny, hopefully it's not windy, but I wish that for you. And also one other thing too, if you're enjoying what you're getting here, or you want to contribute to the direction of the program as it currently is, I really encourage you to check out the website, which is in the description, and also the Facebook page. Go like that, because then you can stay up to date and get some quotes, inspiration, other tips and tricks and ideas as well. If the podcast takes a bit of a hiatus, then you'll be in the know as to when things come back in an evolved form. And now back to the show. Yeah, I'm excited to see where the future goes then with the science. Do you have any quick tips on ways that you might integrate a bit of deliberate rest? What are some examples of what that could look like?
Yeah, so we're trying to build, with teachers, with educators, we're really trying to choreograph lesson planning in a more scientific, strategic way. You know, I think teachers traditionally have been very good at designing lessons around learning content, but we've not been very good at designing lessons around the human experience. And what we're seeing in the best educators in the world is an intuitive kind of recognition that you need to kind of manipulate, play with human emotions throughout a lesson. Like, there needs to be highs and lows. And, you know, just as you would in a normal theater production or in a song or whatever, whenever humans experience the world in a really dynamic way, it's an undulating kind of emotional experience that keeps us connected. And in a classroom, the best educators choreograph that emotional experience really effectively. But often that's just intuitive rather than being really kind of evidence-informed or deliberate. And so one way we're trying to leverage deliberate practice and deliberate rest and those kind of elements is to empower teachers with the science and then, you know, encourage them to, well, almost suggest that it's an obligation, therefore, once you have the science at your fingertips, to really actively design your lesson plan informed by the science. And so the deliberate practice elements are really about breaking down skills into micro skills, having very specific goal, stretch goals, and really embracing failure and celebrating failure on the way to success. And, you know, and then the deliberate rest are intentionally building in fellow time in a lesson. And that can be everything from, you know, we use meditation regularly, very short meditations or brain breaks, which are designed to have little 1, 2, 3 minute breaks in a lesson to reset brain chemistry, but also encouraging students to have quiet time. You know, one of the most important, most frequently experienced human emotions is serenity, you know, and this comes from Dr. Barbara Fredrickson's work out of the University of North Carolina. And, you know, if you ask teachers to name, you know, the top 10 most important positive emotions, very rarely do they recognize that serenity is one of the most frequently experienced, one of the most important, one of the most powerful positive human emotions we can experience. But often teachers kind of forget that, and it's often about entertainment or it's about really dynamic lessons. But serenity is a really crucial skill, emotional experience, emotional state for humans to be experiencing. And so we're encouraging teachers to build in emotional experience, to build in physiological, to build in neurological experience very intentionally into lesson plans.
That's funny. Yeah, sometimes we don't think about those. It's a little bit hard to pin down sometimes what something like serenity might mean, but now my eyes are attuned to it, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was recently reading about the importance of grit as well, and that's one of the key components of positive accomplishment. And I might define grit as determination, persistence, resilience. This is just from a book called Range by David Epstein, In the Pursuit of Meaningful Work and Goals, so grit towards goals. But I wonder, sometimes it depends how we interpret it, maybe some advice that might be given out about grit might be, you know, not necessarily from the Positive Education Institute, but advice like winners never quit, quitters never win, can be kind of damaging. And I wonder if it restricts our ability to know when to strategically quit and to allow us to explore new opportunities. I wonder what you think about this tension between knowing how much grit to apply to something and how much to persevere with something, but at the same time, knowing when to take a step back and knowing when it's okay to let go.
Yeah, I love that, this exploration. I think, you know, I love Angela Duckworth's work. She was based out of University of Pennsylvania and a kind of a protege of Martin Seligman. And she's her book, Grit, is an international bestseller and one of the most watched TED Talks as well. And we've been very connected with her work for a long time. So we're fascinated with the concept of grit, and it's an essential component of high performance. But it's probably, along maybe with growth mindset, it's maybe one of the most overexposed or misunderstood elements of the science. And in part because it feels so intuitive, like it feels so right that, you know, we want kids to be working hard, whatever. Perseverance is a great thing. And so teachers grab this concept at a superficial level and without really understanding perhaps the real depth and the nuance of the work that Duckworth and others have been really helping us understand. And so, you know, so grit is this really essential component, passion and perseverance for long-term goals is the way Duckworth defines it, and very similar to your definition. But, you know, as we've seen in the last couple of years, there's been an explosion of people grabbing this grit concept and using it as a badge of honor or something. Or, you know, even Carolyn Adams Miller wrote a book where she explained the different sort of anti-grit or negative grit kind of concepts that people have been demonstrating. So things like stupid grit is one of the elements that Carolyn Adams Miller talks about. Stupid grit is where we just, you know, consistently keep persevering in the face of constant failure and without changing strategy or tack, you know. So there's no point in consistently doing the same thing if it's not working for you. And stupid grit is, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, what teachers encourage when they say, just keep trying. You know, it happened to me in about year 7 or 8 maths, where I started to really struggle a bit with maths. And I was a good student, but maths, you know, becomes conceptual around the age of, you know, 13, 14, 15. And really the advice from my teacher when I started struggling was just keep trying. And I did, and it didn't get me anywhere because I had a terrible strategy. And so actually I fell out of love with maths and really, you know, since that point, have never enjoyed maths at all because I was gritty, but it was stupid grit, you know. And you know, the other elements of grit are things like selfie grit. So again, Carolyn Adams Miller concept of people pretending to be gritty just so they can put a post on Instagram showing how gritty they are, you know, so it's grit for the sake of grit is pretty stupid. And false grit's the other kind of concept we come across where people claim they're gritty when actually they're not, and it's really, again, a badge of honor kind of concept. And so grit's an essential part of human flourishing. It's an essential part of human performance, but we've got to be very careful with it. And you know, the downside of grit is really worrying, you know, people persevering at the sake of other elements of their well-being. And you know, I think the PERMA model of the 6 different domains of well-being, that concept, that framework is important because it allows us to recognize that whilst grit and perseverance are really cool for accomplishment, we've got to be careful that we don't harm other domains of well-being like relationships. And it's the classic kind of offset that grit in your life, Daniel, I imagine, and certainly in my life, I have quite high levels of grit. And therefore, that sometimes harms my relationship with friends and family because I'm too busy, immersed in a project I'm doing and forget to call my cousin for his birthday or whatever, you know. So we have to be very careful with grit that it doesn't impact on other level, other domains of our well-being. And the last thing I want to say just to your question, Daniel, is that I'm a big fan of Seth Godin's work. He's an American author, writer, philosopher, really. And one of the most impactful books I've read in a long time is called The Dip, written by Seth Godin. And effectively in that book, his thesis really is, you know, that humans really should quit more. You know, that healthy humans quit all the time. You know, we recognize that we can't do everything. We can't be everything. And if we're doing something that's not giving us passion, that doesn't really light us up, you should quit. Go and choose, you know, find something that does light you up and invest in that, you know. And I think in our society where we value this grittiness, persistence, his theory, which is, you know, has influenced mine, is that we sometimes embrace grit rather than passion, or we get so caught up in just wanting to achieve that we lose track of why we're trying to achieve in the first place.
I love that. It's funny you mentioned Seth Godin as well, actually, because it came up in that exact same chapter that I was reading. So there you go.
Right, yeah.
Another thing, actually, that I wonder about grit is that sometimes, perhaps, we have goals set for ourselves when we're very young. This is another thesis in the book. And that as we grow older, that's not necessarily the case, as we have more responsibility and take more control over our own direction in life. To what extent do you think it's valuable to kind of roll with whatever goals might be set for us when we're really young and to have grit in pursuing those? Or, and then how do you suppose do you balance that with, well, let's explore other things that you might be passionate about?
I think the way we're trying to think about that question is such a pivotal question, really, because we want to allow our children, our students, to understand the benefit of grit and of perseverance for long-term goals. You know, I think in a world where we have so much instant gratification and we have, you know, notifications on our phone all the time and instant Facebook, you know, updates and stuff, the concept of long-term goals and staying gritty to pursue long-term goals is an important skill that we have to learn. You know, that's not a natural kind of state, instinctive state for humans. Really, long-term goals are something we have to really learn about and learn the value of. It's a really important element of humanity that you kind of have to learn as you grow up, you know. And I think there's a risk that if we fail to help our students understand the value of long-term goals, then they can get caught up in this nihilistic kind of pursuit of immediate gratification. So long-term goals are really important. On the flip side, you know, we have to be careful that we are not imposing goals on students or on our own children, that we enable them to explore the world, to find their own passion, to, you know, to be open to experience. You know, I think it's a really important tension, a place of friction, I think, in well-being science at the moment, is to really tolerate the ambiguity or to tolerate the tension between allowing us to understand the value of long-term goals and passion and perseverance towards those goals, at the same time being able to embrace the constant changing reality of a child's experience and the dynamism of the world at the moment, the pace that the world's accelerating, the fact that you and I, Daniel, are old. You know, we were born in an age really before the internet existed, and, you know, compared to our students, we live in a different dimension, kind of, you know. And so there are so many elements of their world that you and I can't understand because we're not born in a purely digital native experience. You know, even the idea of a virtual versus a real world, you know, I think you and I instinctively understand that there's a real world and there's a virtual world, a digital world, and they're kind of quite distinct. But for students, that's untrue. You know, their digital world is their real world and there's a real blurring. And so all of that to say that it's difficult. It's challenging. I think we have to enable students to be open whilst trying to allow them to embrace and stay with meaningful long-term goals as well. So it's a really interesting, challenging element.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes that I know what they're like, and I don't think I do.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm a little bit of a dinosaur myself sometimes. I have like no Facebook notifications and stuff. So yeah. I'm a young teacher, but yeah. I'd like to pivot now and talk a little bit about some of your background in the positions that you've had throughout your career, the journey that you've had throughout your career. Were there some key turning points for you, and how did you go about making decisions to navigate those? Did your decision-making process change over time, or did you embrace opportunities? Could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I've always had a deep passion for helping, supporting students, children, I think. And part of that's, I think, due to my background, my upbringing, my personal experiences as a teenager, and just have always felt a calling to wanting to be there with teenagers mostly. You know, that's been my area of expertise and passion and experience. I also had a mum who's a PhD in education teacher and a brilliant teacher. And growing up, I saw that how hard it is to be a teacher, you know, the level of commitment and the level of emotional investment you have, and the how time poor teachers are, and the conditions are challenging. And so actually when I left school, all I knew is that I didn't want to be a teacher. I didn't want to be in schools. That was the only thing I knew, really. And I tried to avoid teaching and education, schooling for a long time and studied psychology, but just got pulled back in towards kids and schools and stuff. And so I think, to be honest, the evolution of my career has been about understanding myself, learning to really understand my own life, my own position in the world, the way I grew up and things that happened to me and my responses to those, and that's been my passion for psychology, is to really understand myself and other people, and then to embrace where that's taken me, which is to a real passion, a connection with young people. And so really I think my career has evolved as I've learned more about myself and been really tried to be true to what lights me up. And I think I deeply believe that, that people are like plants, really like trees, that they're either growing or they're dying, and I think I see that in too many teachers educators where their career kind of fizzles out towards the end because they're not growing and they're not changing and evolving. And so I have this passion for growth and for really staying true to what lights me up. I love my work and I always have. I've had a whole range of different jobs, but I've always been excited every day to get up and do what I do. And I think that's where I've pursued, not really had any great career aspirations per se. I'm not trying to be the next principal of Geelong Grammar School. I'm not trying to make $1 billion. My real driving catalyst and the energy for me is making a difference and being excited by the work that I'm doing. And so I think I've always pursued that, the excitement, the passion, I want to get out of bed every day, just chomping at the bit to get to work. And I've been lucky that as my career has evolved, I've, been able to take those opportunities. And and that's taken me to different countries. I've taught in 3 different countries now, and really each time I've moved or each time my career's evolved, it's been in the pursuit of new excitement and challenge. And and challenge is a really important part. I know it's a real interest area of yours, Daniel, the challenge and failure and pursuit, and I think I love being a bit rubbish, kind of in the wrong way, it's a strange way to put it, but I love challenge and I love being pushed and I love being at the edge of my capabilities, and that's what really does light me up. And that's not for everyone, and my wife's quite different. She's a much more centered kind of human person, or it's hard to describe, but I think whilst she's very ambitious and amazing what she does, I think I prefer being at the beyond my limit. Like, I love that liminal space between success and failure, and that's where I just am at my best, I think, and that's where I can help raise others up as well, that's been my the story of my career so far, I think.
That's hilarious. So is it almost like when you get to a point, when you're at the cutting edge, now you start to feel a bit rubbish because you don't have all the knowledge anymore, and so that's what then becomes exciting, and that's when you might go somewhere new?
Yeah, it's exactly right. And I love meeting people that are more skillful, more knowledgeable, smarter than me. And I love just being I like being a student. I'm a student of humans, and I love looking up in awe at other humans that are amazing in their skill set or their capacity or their intellect or their philosophy. And I love that experience of being constantly challenged and growing and evolving. And so for me, that's where, when I'm in a career, a job, an opportunity like that, that's when I'm really lit up. And when that starts to fade for me, when I become comfortable, that's where I think I try to seek new challenge and adventure.
Okay. And then throughout that process, I imagine, when you say there are some inspiring humans, have you ever had a moment with one of them, maybe that you worked with, a mentor figure, for example, that's encouraged you? Because I'm wondering sometimes what that encouragement looks like and how we can almost adopt it as self-talk to ourselves.
I've been blessed to have had so many mentors in my life. There's probably two that I mentioned briefly that might be helpful. And I love what your framing of the question around the self-talk, because I carry these mentors with me in my mind all the time. little bit like kind of Yoda, right? I kind of imagine that they're kind of with me in the spirit, whatever, in the world, somewhere in the universe or whatever. Peter Corkill was my first kind of boss, I guess, at McKinnon Secondary College in Melbourne, was my first real teaching gig. And Peter was the deputy head at the time there. He's now the principal of Monash, the science school attached to Monash University in Melbourne. I remember my first year of teaching there, I was teaching a little bit of year eight history, and we had this set curriculum, and it was about medieval history, and really nice textbook and really nice lesson plans, and the head of humanities at the time was great, and I felt really supported, and it was really nice little course I was teaching. And I had this idea one day to just completely throw that out the window and explore this long-term project with these kids about the Battle of 1066, the Battle of Hastings, and some guy gets an arrow in his eye. And I had this idea that, you know, could we trace that, that arrow hitting a guy's eye in the Battle of Hastings to somehow trace through history to the point where we're sitting in McKinnon Secondary College 500 years later, kind of thing, and just just create a timeline kind of thing, and just try and trace history, which was a ridiculous abstract concept. And I just said to I just remember walking to Peter and saying, you know, can I put the curriculum in the bin and just try this experiment with these kids for 6 months? And I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how it's going to turn out. And just remember his eyes like lighting up with him just saying, go for it. Like if you can see an angle that's going to light up your students, embrace that. And so that was, I just remember that moment with Peter recognizing that, yeah, I'm a professional educator, and of course we have obligations. And we are also allowed to think differently, you know, and that unlocked kind of a moment for me, I think, where for the rest of my teaching career and then beyond that, I've almost been inspired to challenge the status quo, to constantly ask, could this be done better? Is there a more exciting way to do this? So always trying to be respectful of tradition and where we are and what's got us to this point, but also constantly asking, could this be done better? Is there something more exciting? Is there a different way to think about schooling or education, whatever? So that was a real pivotal moment for me that constantly stays with me. Could this be done better? The other moment, the other mentor for me, probably I'll mention, is John Hendry, who's was the Director of Student Wellbeing at Geelong Grammar for a long time. He's an Order of Australia award winner, has recently retired, but brilliant man, still working very active in wellbeing science and schooling and education. His kind of piece of advice, I think, that stuck with me, he's probably the wisest educator I've ever come across. And I just remember going to his office one day and whinging and complaining about something that was happening in a kind of pastoral kind of wellbeing thing in the school. And I was just a bit fired up, a bit angry about this thing that had occurred. And just remember John, he's such a gentle, wise man, but asking me this question, which keeps coming back into my life, that like he's just kept saying to me, David, I can see you're upset and challenged. And when you go back out there, in spite of all of this challenge, who are you going to be? So who are you in the face of this? In the face of this challenge, in the face of this frustration, who are you going to choose to be? You know, and so really empowering me he was acknowledging my anger and frustration and could see that, but then put back on me this question of, and now I have a choice, you know, how am I going to behave? How am I going to respond to this? Who are you in the face of this? And I think that question keeps coming back into my life. Dr. Maria Sawara, wonderful psychologist, American psychologist who we work closely with, reminded me of that question recently. And it's been probably the most important question in my teaching career, especially in my professional career, especially this year, you know, when life's hard and life sucks a lot of the time. But in spite of all of that, to keep asking yourself the question, in spite of all the rubbish that's going on in your life and the challenge and the frustration, who am I in the face of this? Who am I choosing to be today when I walk into my class and the kids are annoying and they haven't done their homework? Who am I in the face of this? You know, and so those two kind of pivotal mentors and pivotal moments, Peter Corkill kind of unlocking this, you know, challenge to status quo. And then on the other hand, John Hendry saying, that you have a choice in terms of how you behave despite of what's going on around you. Who are you in the face of this?
Thank you so much for sharing. I feel like that's such a wise way of looking at it, and it's probably organic in some way, this idea of the like the Yoda, you know, the angel on your shoulder that stays with you.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a great. I really like that. All right, final question. As we emerge from lockdown, I wonder about these positive self-talk, if there is anything that we can do to continue to look after our mental health as we go into this new phase, COVID normal.
Two things I'd like to say to that. One is that the Surgeon General in the Obama administration was a guy called Vivek Murthy, and he's just written a book called Together. And he's a brilliant doctor, but he's just really articulating this wonderful book released this year, how important relationships are to mental health. And particularly in it, he suggests that, you know, obviously that we have to have powerful intimate relationships, as in relationships with people that we feel very close to, that really know us well, people that we happily hang out in our pajamas with, kind of thing, that level of intimacy with people. And we need to have social relationships with people who are friends, you know, and people we're connected with, and a kind of tribal connection connected to an organization or a group of people that have a shared purpose. And so these different levels of connection, humanity, have been broken by COVID. You know, our connections, our intimate connections have been challenged. You know, I haven't given my mum a hug in months. Our social connections are damaged and fractured because I haven't hung out with my mates for ages. And this sense of shared purpose is challenged because, you know, schools and we don't know what's happening and how's everything going to be next year. And, you know, everything that's been, we're being faced with, our organizations are challenged. And so, you know, the most fundamental, the deepest heart of humanity is this desire to feel safe, to feel seen, and to feel that we belong, right? To feel safe, seen, and that we belong. And all of those elements, I think, for most people, if not all people during this experience, have been somehow eroded a little bit. None of us quite feel 100% safe. None of us quite feel 100% seen, and we don't feel we belong in the same way because of the relationships have been fractured and challenged. And so I think the most important thing of all, as we, you know, endure this experience and as we emerge from this experience, is to focus on those three things. The most important, the deepest parts of our humanity, is to ensure that we and our people around us, people we care about, feel safe, first of all, and doing everything we can to make ourselves and others feel safe, to do everything we can to make ourselves and others, our students, feel seen. You know, that we look people in the eye, that we use people's names, that we reach out, that we know, we allow people to feel seen and to feel that they belong, that we belong. It's about rekindling those connections with community, with family, you know, because ultimately humans are a tribal, you know, a species that depend on each other. And so for me, that's the absolutely most fundamental element. So we feel safe, we feel seen, and we belong. And anything we can do to harness that, to embrace that for ourselves and others, I think are absolutely crucial.
That's an excellent way of framing it. I'm looking forward to, yeah, this new chapter and seeing how we go with that. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on board today and sharing about your career journey and also the influence of positive education, the different stages of your career and the different forms that it's taken as well. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sure our listeners will get a lot out of it as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time, Daniel. Great to be on your podcast, and keep doing the awesome work you're doing. It's really inspiring as well. So thanks for the connection. Good luck with it all. Stay well.
Cheers. Thanks.
Thank you for joining me there for another episode of the Fall Summits podcast. If you'd like to learn a little bit more about the project and what it's about, you can head over to the website at fallsummits.org. There is an archive of a few different episodes there as well, and some other resources, so be sure to check that out. If something spoke to you in that episode, consider sharing it or leaving a review on iTunes. The link is in the description. And of course, a big thank you to you, the listener, for tuning in for this episode and being part of the conversation, which is fantastic. I really wish you all the best for reflecting on your own journey and decision-making. Fall Summits partly owes its existence to Claire Fogarty and Michael Zampogna, two stalwart creatives and longtime friends. A huge thank you to Claire for her music production, and to Michael for the uplifting design that you see before you on your screen. Alright everyone, that's it from me for today for this episode. I'll see you next time. Take care.